The Days of Our Years by Book Hobbit. An account of John Childermas's first 7 years in Mr. Norrell's service. Chapter 4, 1792. January 1792. Childermas brings in the mail and leaves it on the desk. Norrell picks it up absently and leaves through it, sorting as he goes into burn, deal with, and leave for Childermas to deal with. A request to see his library. A business letter. Another library request. Several more letters on matters of business. Request from old school friend for money. Norrell sneers at this, as if anyone from school would have called him their friend. At the bottom of the pile, there is an odd-looking letter. It has black borders, he realizes. Who could possibly be? A funeral invitation. His breath comes quick. It is for his uncle, of course. His father's elder brother. His last remaining close relative on that side, he thinks. None now. That, at least, is a blessing. He will have to go to the funeral. It is highly unfortunate, but he cannot think of any way around it. Not to do so would invite too many questions, and he cannot risk the possibility that someone will come here and question him about it. Norrell stares at the invitation and feels his throat closing in dread. He rings for Childermas, of course. Childermas appears from whatever business he was on, something to do with the household staff, which Norrell has increasingly had him managing. "Sir," he says, "what is the matter?" Norrell flaps his hands unhappily and then begins rubbing them together, far too worried to stop himself. It is only Childermas. He says, "Read the letter." Childermas plucks the missive off the desk and reads through it, leaning against the desk. "Were you close to your uncle?" he says. "Not remotely." Norrell makes a face. "Nevertheless, I must go." Childermas nods. "Your relatives," he says. "The ones who will be there. When did they see you last?" "Since before I was in breeches, most of them," says Norrell.
"I see. It's going to be difficult to explain where you are now," says Childermas.
"Yes." The tight, white, anxious feeling in his throat grows. I cannot. Childermas comes to stand beside Norrell. "You are all right," he says quietly. "You do not need to do anything you do not want to. Tell me what it is you cannot do, and I will ensure that it does not happen." Norrell closes his eyes and takes a few deep breaths.
I cannot dress. I cannot pretend to be."
"No," says Childermas. "No, that is not the solution. I would never have suggested that. Breathe, sir." Norrell sucks in another breath and nods. "We will make this work," says Childermas. His tone is firm and reassuring, and it makes Norrell's breathing ease.
"I do not know how," he says crossly. "I do not see how it can be done."
"Well, what have you done thus far?" Childermas pulls up a chair next to Norrell and sits in it. "You need not tell me anything you do not wish to, but I need to know what measures you took to prevent discovery." Norrell nods again. "I am an only child, but I had the records changed so that my parents had 2 children. A girl who died when she was very young, and a boy who survived."
"How secure are you that the changes have stuck?"
It was years ago, and the judge I bribed is dead now, so I do not think there will be any threat from that corner. I have changed all the documents in my own family's possession, Norrell says. But I do not know what explanation to give them to tell them why they never saw him, me, when I was a child.
You were sickly, supplies Childermas. You could not travel. Your parents did not wish to speak of you because they were afraid you would die.
Norrell shivers. Supposing they ask too many questions.
And find what? That the records show there were two Norrell children and one dad. Here you are. Nothing to question. You said you were not close to them.
I do not believe they will care.
Norrell clutches the arm of his chair and nods a final time.
We have it under control, says Childermas.
And they do. Childermas promises to go and see the records, and when he returns he assures Norrell that all is well. So Norrell goes to the funeral, wearing stiff and unfamiliar black clothing new bought for this occasion. The funeral itself is not so bad. Very few people make noise, and he is able to ignore the sermon. But after the funeral, there is the house to go to. Being a full day's journey away, Norrell is invited, like most of the family, to stay the night at the uncle's former mansion. This means he is, unfortunately, required to go to supper. The atmosphere is not very funereal. He supposes nobody liked the man any more than he did, but this means there are a large number of people talking around him and making noise. There is jostling and all sorts of strong smells, and he feels thoroughly lost and overwhelmed. His head aches. The lady next to him says,
Norrell, is it not? I take it you are Edmund and Cecy's boy, then?
Yes, says Norrell, tensing.
I did not know they had one. I thought they had a girl. Have you a sister?
Asks the lady. I did. She died.
How tragic. It is curious that they never spoke of you.
I was sickly. They thought I would die too, says Norrell. He thinks too late that perhaps he ought to have phrased that differently. The lady's eyebrows rise.
Gracious, she says. Tragedy haunts your family, I see. I am very sorry to hear that. Well, it is nice to have met you. I do wish I saw Edmund and Cecy more before they were gone.
Norrell clears his throat. Many have said the same, he says. This is not strictly true. He has not spoken to any of his family's friends since he was 13 years old.
Well, Mr. Norrell, what do you do?
I study magic, madam, says Norrell. He cannot help the faint trace of excitement that creeps into his voice at this. The lady laughs and nudges the man next to her.
Mr. Norrell studies magic. Cecy's son, do you remember? Who would have thought?
Ah, says the man, leaning forward. Have you seen any fairies lately, Mr. Norrell? That, no, says Mr. Norrell. That is not what magic is about at all. The man laughs as well.
Well, we all know what magicians are, he says. I am sure you are theoretical, no doubt.
Yes, says Norrell. There is certainly no chance of him revealing his true profession. Not in this crowd.
Well, that's all right, then, says the man. Everyone knows that practical magicians are charlatans, don't they?
Norrell looks down unhappily. He would say the same of any other practical magician with no hesitation. That is certainly true. But it is most uncomfortable to hear himself described this way. He says, yes, certainly. He is forced to endure the other diners' opinions on magic for the rest of the supper. It is very difficult not to begin talking about it, but it feels unwise. He moves his hands under the table, agitatedly, when the subject comes back up. Even worse, people keep asking him about his sister. He is obliged to invent an imaginary illness for her, and he keeps getting the details confused. By the time the meal is over, he is shaky, overwhelmed, his head full of fluff, and his movements uncoordinated. He feels as though he is slogging through mud. He wants nothing more than a quiet moment alone, to read, and get himself back together. He hurries toward his room, thinking of a book he had left on the arm of the chair to read when he returned. As he lets himself in, he goes over the plan in his mind. Read until he calms down. Perhaps have a cup of tea. The book is not there. Norrell had put it there specifically. He knows he did. He remembers distinctly. But it is not there. He looks around on the floor in case it should have fallen, but it is not. That, there, is the final straw. There is the split-second wave of mindless panic that breaks and leaves behind anger, and he cannot stop it. He sits down in the chair, hides his eyes in one hand and balls the other into a fist. He begins to rock, and the trembling starts. To his own horror, he begins to cry, his shoulders shaking. This does not happen often during fits, only especially bad ones. He had not quite realized, until this very moment, just how deeply he was affected. But he is not alone. This is someone else's house. He cannot give in. He cannot stop it. Childermas comes in with a book a few minutes later. He looks at Norrell evenly.
"Go away,"
says Norrell, fitting it in between silent gasps. He hates Childermas then. Childermas and himself and his relatives and the book that was not there. He hates everything. Childermas sets the book down on the arm of Norrell's chair, within his reach. "Do you need anything?" he says. Norrell shakes his head. He cannot form more coherent sentences right now. But Childermas leaves and shuts the door. And so Norrell collapses, quietly, with the pain of it, embracing it fully, pulling it down into him. If he does not resist, it will be over sooner, and purged from him. He rocks, remembering the awful mixture of shame and terror and physical discomfort. The sobs, at least, are mostly silent. Occasionally, one he cannot repress slips out, or a wet gasp for breath will emerge. But he does not think anyone will hear him. At least the tears lessen the urge to scream. Childermas brings tea at the end, just as he always does. Norrell is distantly grateful that this has become routine, even though he is not sure how Childermas always knows when it is over. It is very comforting to have a hot cup in hand when he is coming down from the intensity of the experience. "Come, sir," says Childermas, and his voice is quiet and low and clearly calculated not to upset Norrell's sensibilities. "It would be best for you to go straight to bed." Norrell nods. Childermas moves to help Norrell undress, and his hands are gentle. He takes Norrell's coat, and the sliding touch of cloth over his arms makes Norrell shiver, but it is over soon. His fingers are still too unsteady to undo his cravat. Childermas' hands on his throat as he helps him with it should alarm him, but they are soothing. There is a slow tenderness to it that makes him feel, he does not know, safe, perhaps, in the way that a warm house does, after coming in from a rainstorm. Mechanically, he responds to Childermas' nudges, turning this way and sitting down and holding his arms out until he is ready for bed. By the time the routine is done, he feels calmer. "Do we need to do anything about your relatives?" says Childermas. "I do not believe so," says Norrell. His hands have almost stopped shaking. "I do not believe any of them noticed. None passed any remarks. Childemas nods.
Good, he says.
Where was the book? Says Norrell.
In your trunk. One of the maids wanted to come in and do your cleaning, so I took it and put it away. I know you do not like people to see them.
Oh, says Norrell. He thinks he would normally be cross about that, but he is too tired.
Do you require anything more of me, sir?
No, says Norrell, and Childemas bows. For a moment he looks as if he wants to say something, or do something. But Norrell is far too scattered to put the effort into puzzling out what it might be. Childemas goes out, with the urge apparently unexecuted, so he supposes it does not matter. Norrell is asleep soon after. They do not speak of the incident in the morning.
July, 1792. Childemas is doing the household accounts. Technically, this should not be his job, but the housekeeper resigned 6 weeks ago. Norrell had given him permission to hire another, but he has been having difficulty finding anyone. He is considering hiring a housemaid instead, and taking over some of the managerial aspects himself, permanently. It is not as though he needs more to do, but it might be easier in the end. It is very late at night. Norrell has got it into his head to stay up studying, which he does sometimes. Childemas could go to bed, but he will only spend it wondering if Norrell ever got to bed and if he will be cranky in the morning. In any case, Childemas has enough work to fill the time with. A night spent catching up would not be amiss. So they are sitting there, in peaceful silence, Childemas calculating carefully, and making tiny, loose, absent-minded sketches in the margins of his scrap paper. The current one is turning out to be Norrell's hands. Again. He has been drawing them frequently lately, which is a bit confusing. He supposes it must be something to do with seeing Norrell more than anyone else. The urge to capture something with perfect realism. Or perhaps it is because, by now, he looks at them very frequently to ascertain Norrell's mood. A tiny sound breaks into his composure. He looks up, around, and then at Norrell, whose shoulders are shaking. Childemas frowns. He looks nothing like he does when he's crying, one hand covering his mouth, but his eyes are facing down and scrunched up at the corners instead of squeezed shut. Another small sound escapes Norrell, and Childemas realizes with a shock that he is laughing. It is nearly silent and breathy, as if he has not had cause to use his lungs this way often. Childemas blinks. He has never, in 3 years, seen Norrell laugh before. He has a strong urge to draw the picture in front of him, to draw this strange new openness. Pin it to the page like a butterfly before it disappears. There is something in the lines of Norrell's eyes that loosens in laughter, making him look younger, less pinched. Childemas wants to reach out and straighten his shoulders, look him full in the face, so he can explore what it is. He shakes his head quickly. It is ridiculous. In any case, Norrell is even now regaining his composure, dropping his hand, taking a deep breath. What was so funny? Asks Childemas.
Norrell glances up at him and winces, as if he had forgotten Childemas was there.
It is nothing, he says. It did not sound like nothing.
It was nothing that should have been humorous. Norrell turns away and begins reading his book again. When he does, a small smile appears on his face. He squishes down without complete success, and it strains the corners of his mouth.
Come on, then, says Childemas, getting up from his desk. You cannot hide it.
I could use a good laugh.
No, Norrell protests, hiding the book behind himself. But since he does not have a bookmark and clearly does not want to lose his place, this merely enables Childermas to say it more clearly. He strides over to the chair and peers at it. He gets a hint of the words Cumbria and hunting and William before Norrell realizes his mistake, squeaks angrily, and whooshes the book face down on the table.
It is a tale of the Raven King. It is, Childermas realizes, the Cumbrian charcoal burner. The story has come up in one of Norrell's books. Norrell, who flinches when you say the name John Uskglass, is reading the tale of the Cumbrian charcoal burner and laughing at it. How very strange the world is.
That has always been one of my favourites, says Childermas.
I told you that I should not have found it funny, says Norrell.
It is the hour.
But it is a funny story.
It is almost entirely apocryphal.
That does not lessen the humour.
I know some other stories of him, says Childermas, if you want to laugh. He finds the words softening at the edges, less sarcastic than he intended them. He shakes himself internally.
I do not, says Norrell sharply. It was a momentary slip of composure and nothing more, occasioned by a late night and an overindulgence in wine at dinner.
You did not drink wine at dinner. You generally do not when you dine at home alone. You have told me it interferes with your digestion.
Norrell's lips press together.
Never mind that, he says irritably. Must you ask questions about everything?
I have not asked any questions, says Childermas patiently. I have only made statements.
Leave me in peace, Childermas, says Norrell.
He returns to his book, but the smile creeps back onto his face again, and Childermas finds himself unable not to echo it. Perhaps he himself is a little bit drunk on the hour and the dizzying array of numbers, and on the unexpected new knowledge he has gained. He snorts, and Norrell looks up. Their eyes meet. Childermas says, without entirely planning the words out,
I thought you hated him.
The smile disappears. Norrell's face instantly shuts down, his eyebrows drawn together. He says,
I do not know what you are talking about.
Childermas wants to follow the topic to its logical end, but he can practically see briars growing out of Norrell at an allusion to his feelings on the Raven King, and so he does not. He files it away, though, for the future, for a day when Norrell will trust him enough to tell him. And he files away the look of Norrell's laughter, of those tiny soft lines at the corners of his eyes, to draw. Next time he is in need of some subject. For practice, he tells himself. Practice only. He cannot quite make himself believe this. November, 1792. In November, Norrell takes it into his head to go to a book sale in Ugthorpe, instead of sending Childermas by himself.
There will be a great deal of Greek, he says. Your Greek is not quite good enough yet. I shall need to inspect them myself.
It does not worry Childermas. So they set off the day before the sale, Norrell wrapped in an absurd number of garments against the growing winter chill. The ride there, he follows his usual practice of dismounting every few hours, so as to make it easier on his legs, which means he has to ride faster to catch up. This seems to vex Norrell. The third time he stops and catches up, Norrell pokes his head out of the window of the coach and says,
"Get inside. I am tired of you lagging behind."
Childermas raises his eyebrows. Servants are not supposed to ride with gentlemen, not on journeys like this. But he is not going to look a gift horse in the mouth. He shrugs and dismounts. Noddle taps for the carriage to stop, and Childemas sees to the horse. He climbs inside and sits across from Noddle.
It will be easier for you to ride inside, I take it, says Noddle.
Childemas nods.
In the future, if we are travelling together, I would request that you would ride inside, Noddle says. It makes me dizzy to see you so continuously inconsistent in your pace.
Childemas bows his head. Even now he cannot tell if Noddle is genuinely bothered by this, or if he wishes to make things easier for Childemas, but does not want to be found out. He supposes it does not matter. The end result is the same. Things proceed smoothly until they reach the junction to turn towards Whitby or Oakthorpe. When they stop off at the coaching inn to change horses, Childemas overhears two men talking about bandits on the road ahead. He stops and talks to them, and checks his cards. Yes, he does not think it is safe, not with night coming on. Childemas goes to speak to Noddle, who is already in the coach, tapping his foot impatiently as he waits to begin.
We cannot move ahead, he says. Not yet. I have an uneasy feeling about the road.
Bother feelings, says Noddle.
I asked around, Childemas says. There are unpleasant characters up ahead, I tell you. We will not be safe.
But we have to get to the sale on time, protests Noddle.
We have to go on living with our throats uncut is what we have to do, says Childemas. We are not going down that road. We are going to stay here.
Noddle presses his mouth into a thin line.
You are sacked, he says.
No, says Childemas wearily.
You cannot refuse a dismissal.
I believe I am doing so at this very moment, sir, says Childemas. You cannot sack me now. I have to get you home first. Without me, you will be alone on the road save for James. He is a good fellow, but there is only so much he can do. You can sack me when we get back to Hurtview, and you're safe.
I shall, says Noddle. I can promise you that.
He sulks back against the cushions and does not look at Childemas. Childemas sighs. He is far too concerned about their safety to spare any worry for Noral's little moods. Back inside, things continue to conspire against any possible cheer. There is only one room available for the night. Childemas sighs to himself again, thinking of how Noral will complain about this, and then he takes the key. The stairs up to the room are very steep. He closes his eyes for a moment, the barest expression of his irritation. As long as this day has been, and as much riding as he has done, even spending half the day in the coach, he does not think he can manage them. Noddle is standing at their base, waiting impatiently for him to come and show him where the room is. Childemas looks at him. On the one hand, they have just had an argument. On the other hand, Noddle did say, whatever you need to do to keep yourself in good working condition. He makes a decision and approaches the stairs. We're up on the first floor, he says. Come, sir. As Noddle begins to ascend, Childemas reaches out one hand and lays it on his shoulder for balance and support. Noddle stiffens, but does not move away. They make the whole journey up the stairs like that, Childemas leaning on Noddle, and Noddle allowing it, until they reach their room. Then Childemas lets go. Childemas assumes Noddle will make a fuss about the single bed. He generally does about everything else. But he just looks at it and says, I suspect very strongly that there are fleas.
I'm afraid so, says Childemas. They are endemic to inns, in my experience.
particularly inns that are the only option on a road. If we had gone on to Oakthorpe, Norrell begins, we would possibly be dead. Childemas takes his coat off. I recommend sleeping in your shirt and breeches. A nightshirt might not be wise. Norrell eyes the bed dubiously as he removes his cloak. They undress and settle down to bed quickly. It has been a very long day. Childemas waits for Norrell to complain about his proximity. But he does not. He does take most of the covers, pulling them over himself as he curls into a sort of nest. Childemas is too tired to protest this. He has slept through far worse than a blanket-stealing bedmate. Presently, Norrell says,
I can feel fleas biting me, Childemas.
I know, sir.
This is intolerable.
As you say, sir. Childemas is beginning to drift off already, fleas or no fleas.
I will complain to the innkeeper, says Norrell. I shall not be able to sleep a wink. The quality of the mattress is dreadful.
Just try to ignore it, mumbles Childemas into his pillow. There is a pause.
I am still upset about the book sale, says Norrell. You have acted most impertinently. I do not believe we will get there in time.
If we could save this discussion for the morning, says Childemas, closing his eyes. Norrell is silent for a while. Then he mutters something like,
intolerable level of hygiene,
and curls up deeper into his blankets. Childemas does not hear any more. Shortly after, he falls asleep. He awakens around what he judges to be 2 or 3 in the morning. This is not unusual. He is a poor sleeper. Norrell, despite his complaints, is asleep himself. Childemas looks over at him. The covers have been pushed down from his chin to his shoulder. Childemas contemplates stealing some of them back so that they are equally distributed, but decides it is not worth the fuss if Norrell wakes up. In the silence of the early morning, it hits Childemas that he is sleeping beside his employer. He had been far too tired to pay attention before, but now he is gravely aware of the weight of it. It has been a long time since Childemas last shared a bed, and he does not quite know what to do with the information that it is Norrell who is beside him. For all they have been through, this is different, closer, incongruous somehow. He snores a little. Childemas has no doubt that if he mentions this tomorrow, Norrell will deny it and probably accuse him of snoring. Childemas turns over onto his side and looks at Norrell in front of him, curled up small with his back to Childemas. One thin strip of skin visible between his cropped hair and the collar of his shirt. Norrell has just spent the entire preceding evening being terribly petulant with Childemas, and therefore Childemas should not be quite so moved by the sight, by how very vulnerable that strip of skin looks. He reaches out his hand almost without realizing it. Then he stops and lets the hand fall back down, cursing himself for that momentary slip of self-control, although there is no one to have seen it. Means to an end, he thinks, as he watches Norrell breathe slowly and evenly in his sleep. I am here for the magic and the books. Remember. Childemas realizes with a twist that he does not believe that anymore. He does not remember when it stopped being true. He thinks about Norrell's hands, his small pale eyes, his thin, sour mouth. He thinks about the way his shoulders shake when he laughs, or when he cries, or when he has a fit, and about how that makes Childemas want to reach out and steady him. He thinks about holding on to Norrell's arm for balance, and how he said nothing, only let him.
Childemas blows out his breath and realizes that this situation has got quite out of control. In the morning, he is vindicated in at least one respect.
"Lucky to be away with your skins," says the innkeeper when they come down for breakfast the next day and he asks of their plans. "Couple of folks murdered on that road, I heard. Last night there was some sort of incident too."
Childemas shoots Norrell a pointed look, which he ignores. Back at Hurtview, unsuccessful and empty-handed, Childemas asks, "Well, how are you going to sack me?" Right at this very moment, he is so weary and travels so that he does not care. Norrell looks at him and sighs.
"No," he says, "I am not. I need your help. We are going to get those books back, Childemas, if it takes us an eternity. I will not let that man keep them."
It's not very much, but Childemas thinks that "we" might be a mark of trust after all. He tries to put his revelation at the coaching inn out of his mind. It is impractical, an entirely useless encumbrance. How very unfortunate that self-deception has never been one of his strong points.